July 11th program of the City Club of Eugene. Greetings to our broadcast audiences on community television, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Our program today is the Osso Mudslides, Lessons for Oregon. I'm Marlene Nessery, City Club President for 2014 and 15. A special thank you to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the broadcasts on their website. Our sponsors today are Sacred Earth Botanicals, KLCC Radio, and Hearing Associates, Dr. Gail Leslie, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, and Dr. Brad Smith. And for supplying our office space, we thank KPFF Consulting Engineers. A quick reminder that these programs are free for our listening audience, but it does cost real money to produce them and a lot of volunteer effort. So your contributions are most welcome and completely tax deductible. Our program today examines the horrific landslide that struck northwestern Washington State early this spring and asks if and where Oregon might be similarly vulnerable. Our presenters today are Megan O'Hara, Executive Director of the Oregon Pacific Chapter of the American Red Cross, and Professor Josh Roaring of the University of Oregon's Department of Geological Sciences. City Club member Randy Prince, who coordinated today's program, will tell us a bit more about our speakers.
Thank you, Marlene. Today, the City Club will look at the disaster that happened in March up in Oso, Washington. A whole hillside came down, crossed a river, and buried a neighborhood of people. There were almost 50 people killed. Dozens of houses destroyed. The area was closed for quite a while and weeks of digging out. And today we'll hear from somebody who responded, was on the scene within a couple days and stayed there for much of the recovery. We'll also hear from someone who could tell us whether that might happen, something like that might happen in our area. What happened in Oso sounds bad, and you might be thinking, is the good news is that's quite a ways away from here. It is probably 400 miles. It's north of Seattle quite a bit, in the foothills of the North Cascades. The bad news is, yes, it can happen here. We have had not only the landslides that you hear about from time to time that block our highways and divert traffic, but we've had some that washed away whole houses back in the 1990s in particular, and our legislature in Oregon responded with some laws and land use and others to improve our chances and maybe prevent such a disaster. Nonetheless, much of our region is based on slipping land. We even have neighborhoods, residential neighborhoods, or areas that homes can still be built on landslides, just as they did in Alaska when they had a great earthquake and a whole hillside went down in the Turnagain neighborhood. So that's why it's a good idea to look at this and beware of the possibility and see what we can do. On the subject, before we get to our speakers, I want to say one of the controversies in Oso was there advanced knowledge, or was it totally random? Might we have known? In fact, in Washington, they're still arguing about this. Did we have enough warning? And so this program is kind of designed to take a look and see if we should be doing anything more. After we learn a bit more about landslides today, I'd invite you all to attend on October 10th when our state geologist, who has that job of delivering the warnings to our legislature and our agencies, will appear before the Eugene City Club and give us a report card on how well we are doing in heeding warnings of danger, whether they're landslides, earthquakes, or tsunamis. Today, our first presenter is Megan O'Hara. She is a veteran of 7 years with the Red Cross, but is in her first year as the executive director of the chapter in Eugene, the Oregon Pacific chapter. She started her, finished her education in communications at Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, the bachelor's degree there, and went on to serve in public television at several stations in Pennsylvania and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and in our nation's capital, where she later went to work for the Red Cross just before she came here. So, Megan, welcome to the City Club.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. On Saturday, March 22nd, at approximately 10:37 a.m., a mudslide occurred at Oso, Washington, a town with a population of approximately 180. Also affected were Darrington, a population of nearly 1,400, and Arlington, a population of almost 18,000. Oso is situated between Darrington and Arlington. The mudslide lasted for seconds, was over a mile wide, and it destroyed 49 homes, along with other buildings in town. It closed Route 530, blocked the river, which then caused flooding downstream. The death toll stands at 43, with one person still missing. Immediately after the mudslide and flood, hundreds of first responders and search and rescue crews came to the area to help the missing. Also assisting in the search and rescue were family members and townspeople. The work was physically hard and mentally challenging. As the weeks wore on and the search continued, workers began removing debris and trying to clear Highway 530. The road is now open to two-way traffic, but while it was closed, the town of Darrington was basically shut off. What was once a half-hour drive to Arlington for work, shopping, or a doctor's appointment was now a two-and-a-half-hour commute one way. The Snohomish County chapter of the American Red Cross, located in Everett, Washington, immediately responded by opening up shelters in Darrington, Oso, and Arlington. They also began feeding family members, first responders, firefighters, police, and other community members that were affected. As the magnitude of the disaster became clearer, other Red Cross personnel were deployed from the state of Washington, Oregon, California, and states from across the country. Of the initial 200 that were deployed, half were from the state of Washington, 23 were from Oregon. Throughout our entire response, over 500 Red Cross workers were deployed to help with the short and long-term needs of the affected communities. I was initially deployed to assist with external relations and help with our governmental and non-governmental partners. I was then asked to lead our Darrington district. Because of the disaster happening in two locations and both towns being shut off, we had one district in Darrington and one district in Arlington. In the first hours and days of a large disaster, things can be quite chaotic. Sometimes the power is out, the infrastructure is gone, and communication can be spotty or non-existent. So it's very important for us to be working together non-disaster time so that we know what each other brings to the table. And when I say us, I mean local, regional, national levels of government, nonprofit organizations, business community, and community leaders. When a large disaster happens, all of us are affected. The American Red Cross partners with a number of nonprofit organizations in order to best serve the community. During this disaster response, the Southern Baptist helped with feeding. They typically deploy the personnel and equipment, and the Red Cross provides the food and the delivery of meals to outlying areas. We've been partnering with the Southern Baptist for years during large disasters. The Red Cross also partnered with Children in Disaster. This group specializes in working with children and helping them to cope with what was happened. They deploy the teams. The Red Cross provides a location and supplies. We've been partnering with Children in Disaster for years also. The Green Cross provides therapy dogs that help with those directly affected and the community at large, and the Red Cross has been working with this group for a number of years. We also partnered with the National Guard after large disasters. We also partner with FEMA, other state and governmental agencies, along with other local community officials. Some business partners include Tide Loads of Hope, who provide laundry service to the community, and UPS, who has worked with us for years providing free transportation and the use of empty trailers to store items or equipment. Almost every national company supports the American Red Cross through the donation of money, donated goods or services, or by volunteering, with many providing support in all of these areas. Thanks to the generosity of the public, the Red Cross raised over $4 million for this disaster. These funds were donated by individuals, corporations, and groups such as a local Girl Scout troop. We have spent or made commitments to spend almost $2 million, and the remainder of that support will go towards long-term recovery needs of the community. The Red Cross helped families with financial support for funeral expenses, travel and housing expenses, for out-of-town relatives, and for mental health counseling. We also assisted families whose homes were damaged or destroyed and replaced furniture and paid for security deposits, rent, or to help with utilities. We provided bulk items such as storage totes and various cleanup items for those homes that were damaged by the flooding. We also provided hot drinks, water, and other type snack foods for the first responders as they took a break. In order to determine what a family needs, we meet one-on-one with them to really talk through their needs. We also do outreach, where we go door-to-door and talk with as many affected community members as possible. Typically, one downside of a disaster is the arriving unsolicited items. In Darrington, the high school kids, led by a 10th grader, developed a terrific warehouse and distribution system. As unsolicited items were dropped off, they were inventoried and stored, and then the kids would fill boxes with food and other items. Affected family members could receive two boxes of items each day, and for those families that were hesitant to ask for help, other volunteers delivered the boxes to their homes. An event of this magnitude is one that receives a lot of attention, from the governor of the state to the White House to people from around the world. The area was quickly overloaded with calls of support and well wishes. OSO Washington and the surrounding communities have forever been changed by the events of March 22nd. But with the help and support, they'll make it through and hopefully become an even stronger and closer-knit community than they were before this tragedy happened. Thank you.
And thank you, Megan. Our second speaker today will tell us a bit about where and when these things happen, or if we can even know. Today we have with us from the University of Oregon, Professor Josh Roering. He heads up a part of the Department of Geology that goes by the name of Earth Surface Processes Lab. Of course, he wants me to just say it's my gang. There is eight or so doctoral and postdoctorate students that work with Josh on finding out what makes the land slide and where might it. There's a lot of new techniques that have come in. You probably heard of the LIDAR radar. People have also been drilling holes in the ground, figure it all out. There's also issues with logging. Does that have a difference? What plants are growing up top? This is Josh's area of expertise. He came to the University of Oregon after getting his education in the Bay Area, his bachelor's and master's at Stanford, and won his PhD at University of California, Berkeley. So please welcome Josh Roering.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Landslides in Oregon have been a big part of my research program for almost 20 years now, actually. And the motivation for scientific investigation and inquiry is never sharper than after a tragic event like this. And that's OSO is a prime example, and also the 1996 storms that devastated Western Oregon is something I've had experience with. So today I have three things I want to accomplish. The first thing I want to do is lay out the geologic framework and the climate conditions that gave rise to the event that we've been hearing about. The second thing I want to do is explore our susceptibility to landsliding right here in Western Oregon. And along the way, I will highlight one of the biggest questions that Pacific Northwest geoscientists face, and that's how extensive will this landslide response be in the wake of the next magnitude 9-plus subduction zone earthquake? That's a big question for us. Finally, I will describe recent technological advances in our ability to characterize landslide-prone terrain and how this is really changing the game and how we manage this hazard. Now, like most geologists, I'm very visually oriented. I've never given a talk without slides, so today I'm going to be referring, or at least linking to some slides here up on the wall. These are available at the City Club of Eugene website under the links menu, so you can follow along. So first, let's explore what happened just north of us here in Oso. While I have closely followed these investigations, I have not been on site at this location. So I definitely welcome Megan's input and observations along the way. The first thing to note about the event is it was an incredibly wet year. March of 2014 at a nearby rain gauge was the wettest March ever recorded in the 103-year history of that rain gauge. Over 19 inches of rain fell in that month alone, and that's compared with an average of about 8 inches in that part of the world. The hill slope that failed also lies at the outside of a river meander that for decades had experienced episodic migration. And basically the river was poking away at the base of this hill slope. So just think of the game Jenga, if you've ever played it. And you know if you play that game, if you keep moving the blocks at the bottom of the pile, things are not going to end well for you. The hill slope that failed had experienced intermittent landslide activity since before the 1940s, when there was really reliable records there. This was a long-term problem site. And that includes an episode in 2006 that actually dammed the Stillaguamish River, but did not affect any of the homes that lied just across the river from it. In the 1990s and in the 2000s, geologists actually wrote reports on chronic stability problems at this site and advised that timber harvesting, and other management activities on or above that slope should be prohibited. In 2005, however, a 7-acre parcel just above the landslide was clear-cut. Then in 2006, a new subdivision on Steelhead Drive, where many lives were lost, was built just across the river from this intensely studied slope and right in the path of the landslide that occurred this year. So that brings us to March 22nd of this year. Deep-seated failure within this site spawned an unconstrained debris flow, essentially a liquid-like failure, that moved over half a mile across the valley floor. In the process, it buried 50 homes, covered a one-mile stretch of State Highway 530, as we've heard, in tens of feet of sediment, wood, and debris. The Stillaguamish River was dammed for more than 24 hours, flooding upstream areas until a new channel was established through the debris. This event took less than a minute, and the slide approached speeds of 60 miles an hour as it traversed the valley floor. That is according to models as well as seismometers that are in the area. So the geologic conditions that gave rise to this event in Oso are very specific to regions that are right next to giant ice sheets 20,000 years ago. This is a very interesting site. That time period was the height of the last glacial maximum. So think of the children's movie Ice Age. During this period, a 1 mile thick ice sheet covered much of Canada and parts of the U.S., and outwash, rivers, and sediment emanating from these ice sheets deposited tremendous amounts of sediment, some of which accumulated in adjacent valleys, just like the Stillaguamish. So when the ice sheet receded, it left behind these thick stacks of mud and sand, and it left behind a 500-foot cliff of these weak and poorly consolidated deposits. A river has subsequently cut through those deposits, and so we have these 500-foot-high cliffs of very young, very weak sediments, and the combination of steep terrain and weak materials is the perfect geologic recipe for huge, devastating landslides. The topography of the Stillaguamish Valley tells us that the deadly landslide at Oso was only the latest in a series of massive slope failures that have shaped this region over time. Dozens of scalloped, hummocky slopes and runout deposits demonstrate the preponderance of this process in the region. In fact, even more recently, a USGS report since the slide has pieced together the relative ages of dozens of landslides right next door to the one that failed this year, and these have all occurred in the last 10 to 14,000 years. Several of them even register larger than the Oso event that we've just witnessed. In this part of the world, what this is telling us is that the Oso slide that occurred this year was actually par for the course. Now, to be clear, this configuration of terrain and geologic history does not occur here in Oregon. The ice sheets that produce this stack of weak sediments are much too far to our north, but this is not a reprieve. The Oregonians here, us living in Oregon, are not immune from potentially devastating landslides. Far from it, in fact. We just have our own set of geological circumstances that put us at risk. So let's move down to our neck of the woods. And here in Western Oregon, we have two major types of landslides that we need to be thinking about. The first are deep-seated failures that involve the underlying bedrock. Now, these features don't tend to travel great distances, but when they do, they dam rivers and often create lakes. And there's some notable examples not far from here. Triangle Lake was formed when a giant landslide dammed what is now called Lake Creek, and that occurred 50,000 years ago. The lake is still there. Loon Lake, on the way to the coast towards Reedsport, is another example of a more recent giant landslide dam lake. Now, if you look at these features, and these are kilometers in scale, there are thousands of these things littered across our state. And several of these features have been plaguing our efforts to straighten Highway 20. This is the road that goes between Corvallis and Newport. And Oregon taxpayers have been on the hook for over $300 million in the efforts to mitigate sliding at that particular site. Only a handful of these deep-seated slides have moved in recent decades. The vast majority have actually not exhibited any historic activity. Now, the challenging part of that is we don't really have a good handle on what it takes to get these things moving. What does it take to activate them? Now, the thing to think about is to recall that here in the Pacific Northwest, we are living on a subduction zone that generates magnitude 9 or greater earthquakes every 300 to 600 years. And while we know the timing of these seismic events really well, based on sediment records from the ocean floor, we actually have very limited constraints on how the shaking has affected the landscape. That's where we live. My research group and others in the area are currently seeking funding to determine whether these landslides that are scattered all over our state may be associated with these large subduction zone earthquakes. If that earthquake landslide connection emerges, it'll be really important to note that these slides directly abut highways, rivers, railroads, pipelines, and that implies that our disaster response plans must account for blocked roadways, dammed rivers, and even potentially outburst floods associated with these processes. Now, in contrast to these large deep-seated failures I've just sketched out for you, we also live in a zone that is affected by a much shallower type of process. Shallow landslides and debris flows, rather than involving deeper bedrock, involve failure of the soil mantle on the surface. They are typically triggered during intense rainstorm events. If you lived here in Western Oregon back in 1996, you remember these storms. They flooded the Willamette Valley. They spawned thousands of these debris flows. These are rapidly moving failures that essentially behave like fluids, enabling them to careen through the valley network. In 1996, at least two of these resulted in a loss of life. Four were lost near the town of Sutherland, Oregon, and another along the highway near Scottsburg. These events are caused by intense rainfall events, and while we've made progress determining what type of rainfall conditions can lead to their generation across a region, it is really hard to make that prediction on a site-specific basis. Also, the propensity for these shallow debris flows is greatly increased by the loss of root reinforcement that occurs following a timber harvest. After a hill slope has been harvested, there is a 3 to 10 year period of high vulnerability before new roots take hold and reinforce that slope. So those are the two major types. Now, for a moment, I want to touch on technology and how we've increased our ability to characterize these features. We've experienced a massive upgrade in our technological capabilities in the last 10 to 15 years because of the emergence of airborne LIDAR. Now, Google Earth is amazing. Google Earth has been a revelation because it allows us to look at imagery in an easy-to-use interface, but that Google Earth is only as powerful as the imagery in which it serves. Airborne LIDAR is new imagery, new data, and it comes from laser pulses that are emitted from low-flying aircraft, and they allow us to map the surface of the Earth in remarkable sub-meter detail. So this is an example. In the Pacific Northwest, this technology is particularly critical because a significant fraction of the laser pulses can penetrate through the thick veneer of vegetation that cloaks much of our landscape, and we can see the ground before us. As a result, LIDAR has revealed previously unknown active faults and literally thousands of landslides throughout the region. There are numerous examples right here surrounding us in Eugene, on the flanks of Skinner Butte, Spencer Butte, and here along the I-5 corridor. We are very fortunate to have a very proactive and visionary state geological agency here in Oregon. Although vastly underfunded, the Department of Geological and Mineral Industries has built a consortium of interested parties to acquire this LIDAR data across the state, as well as compile and augment a growing database of mapped landslides that includes historical and ancient features. Now, despite all the knowledge of slope stability problems up in Oso in Washington, building and development adjacent to that site continued. Unfortunately, our regulatory framework is currently not well prepared to deal with the uncertainty associated with landslide hazards. They are a tough problem to get your hands around. So here in Oregon, these landslide databases and the LIDAR data sets provide planners and residents with the opportunity to become familiar with our surroundings and acquire the information to make an informed decision about landslide risk. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that fascinating report. Now it's time for us to break so members can form questions for our presenters.
You're listening to KLCC, NPR for Oregonians. In Eugene, 89.7 FM, KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Program the Oso Mudslides Lessons for Oregon with speakers Megan O'Hara and Professor Josh Roaring. We'll take questions now from the audience. Thank you.
Ruth Dimmler. That was such an interesting program, and I learned so much. But I was wondering, how can we find out if we're going to purchase a house? How can we find out what studies have been done? And also, I'd like to know, did you look at a study like this when you bought your first home?
I think that was for me.
Yes, probably from you. Maybe both of you, I think.
On the last slide, I showed a link to the Dogami website. There's two websites that are of interest. One of them is one that has information you should be aware of if you're looking at homes. It's a landslide database. They just released, completely coincidentally, about a month after the Oso event, their updated Slido database. Now, that's a database of over 12,000 historic landslides that have happened in the state of Oregon, and also mapped paleo landslides, ancient features that we know have failed in the past but are not currently active. So you can go to OregonGeology.org, and if you search for Slido, S-L-I-D-O, you can get access to that database. You can even type in your address, and it'll take you right to that location. So they've provided a really easy-to-use, simple interface if you go find Dogami's website. Now, the second thing I would encourage you to check on is the Airborne LIDAR Viewer. All that LIDAR data I've been tantalizing you with is available for anyone to surf through, and you could, I'll warn you, you could lose yourself for hours. I do all the time. Seeing sub-meter things at the inches to feet scale, in some cases, is quite addictive, and seeing the shape of the surface over broad areas is remarkable. Now, all the features, the processes I've been talking about are reflected in this LIDAR data, and if you Google Dogami LIDAR Viewer or go to OregonGeology.org again and just look for that LIDAR Viewer, you will see that almost all of the Willamette Valley and massive chunks of Western Oregon have been covered by their database. So have a look there and maybe have a glass of wine while you do it, because you'd be a while. Now back to the personal aspect of that. You asked if I was able to take advantage of these resources, and this was a while ago, and I will note that I did not. My wife was very pregnant at the time we bought our first house, and I had other priorities. But I did know, based on the topography of our site, that it wasn't a major issue. So I gave it my own assessment, pretty cursory one, because I had other things to do, but I wasn't too worried based on what I found.
Thank you.
Hi, Linda Jensen, City Club member since 2010. I used to work in approving developments in Washington State, and I'm familiar with that they require an environmental impact analysis, the SEPA process there. And I'm wondering, I mean, that usually includes a geotechnical review, and I'm wondering how that got approved, and if there is a geotechnical engineer that said it would be fine, if there's any going back on the people who said that development would be fine. Do you have any information on that?
The specifics of that I don't, and so I'd hesitate to say too much, apart from the fact that that landslide ran out as far as it did was a surprise to many people. And so a lot of the development that occurred before the airborne LIDAR data was allowed us to actually stand back and see that this had happened through the history of this valley. And so trees are remarkably beautiful. It's why many of us love it here. But they also mask a lot of things in the landscape. And I think that realization is really emerged over the last 10 years or so. That we realized that that valley, that particular valley, and a few others in that area were absolutely overridden with these massive slope failures. From a geotechnical standpoint, the timber harvest is very, very small. The recharge area that feeds groundwater to that site is big. And the scale of the change in the water balance that would occur from that timber harvest is likely to be small, but was it big enough to matter is something they're figuring out right now. So colleagues of mine, friends of mine, are on a committee that's doing a lot of work trying to understand what happened there, because as you can imagine, the lawsuits are flying pretty fast around that part of the world now.
James Baldock, City Club member since 2012. You briefly showed a segment with the I-5 corridor here in Eugene. Are there any other geological hotspots in Eugene that you can comment about?
Hotspots in Eugene. Well, one of the big things that when you buy a house is flood hazard. So we all are aware of signing those mortgage papers of looking at flood insurance. And we just don't have that built-in routine of going through and thinking about landslides. And so there are a few lingering out there. There's inactive landslides coming off the flanks of Spencer Butte, actually quite large ones. They are really smooth, and the smoothness comes over time. So imagine a very large feature like this one that occurred in Oso happens. It has sharp edges. A lot of the deposits are angular. Over time, those sharp edges smooth out. So one of the things we see if we see a landslide deposit is that the smoother it is, the older it is. And so a lot of these giant, large landslides on the flanks of Spencer are quite smooth and quite old, suggesting they're not terribly active right now. That said, there are a few segments of them that look like they're fresher and may be something you might want to avoid. Now, I don't want to call anyone out, but you can definitely go onto the database, the landslide map that the Dogami Agency has produced. They are using the LIDAR to actually make distinctions based on these surface characteristics that I'm describing. So they've actually drawn lines around these landslides with those principles in mind, looking for freshness, looking for signs of recent activity. So that's the origin of the polygons, all these shapes, all these colored demarcations on the slopes you'll see when you go to that website. So that one along the I-5 corridor. I also pointed out one right across from on the Coburg Hills, I should say, right next to I-5. And so if you look at those slides I showed earlier, a massive flank of the Coburg Hills came down probably sometime in the last 10,000 years, and was bigger than the OSO event, but again, it's a smoother feature. It doesn't look like it happened very, very recently, but these processes have been occurring around us. We just haven't seen anything in the recent past.
Jerry Diethelm, City Club member. I'm a developer up in the South Hills of Eugene, and I've just purchased 60 acres and some fairly steep topography. And I'm just wondering now if you were to represent the city, city's interests, what kind of report would you require of me to make sure that I've covered all the matters that relate to hazard on that site?
Hmm. I have a whole different kind of degree, but in terms of hazard, I would want to first of all look at air photos through time. One of the great resources we have is to look at the air photo record that started back in the 1930s and 40s when aircraft enabled us to get these bird's eye views. So we've used that in Northern California and parts of Oregon to look at progressive landslide activity through time. So getting a sense of the history of the site and the geology of a site is step one. If it looks like there's signs of movement or there's type of landforms that are characteristic of slope instability, a more detailed look is certainly going to be necessary. In cases where it appears to be problematic, that could involve boreholes, drilling, which starts to become expensive, but really important for characterizing how deep, how fast, things like that, that really hinge on whether sites are feasible or not. So there's an initial first blush kind of assessment that you can do with topographic maps, LIDAR, air photos, and if you see some warning bells arise in that course of those, then it gets a little bit more involved and the engineers start to come in and we have some testing of materials that we can do, as well as more detailed site characterization.
Mike Rose, City Club member. We all know that with any sense of history of the problems we potentially have with the rivers flooding, with earthquakes, what reasonable policies could the governmental agencies pass that might diminish the hazards and the dangers to people?
I think these are all yours.
I'm sorry, I'm hogging the microphone, but
let's go.
Please,
ahead.
Okay. That's a long answer, and one that I'm again not equipped to begin. But I'll just make a couple comments and point out that the event in OSO was one of a handful of landslides that the state was very much aware of, because of the intermittent activity at that site and the geology reports that had occurred at OSO. The state natural resources managers had it on a list. It was on a short list of these are places we worry about. Now, in their worry, I don't think many of them thought that it could behave in the way it did. Remember back in 2006, it moved a little bit, but just didn't show signs that it could do something this large. So in a lot of cases, there is awareness of these trouble spots. And the question is how much we're willing to spend to watch them more closely. Setting up instruments to measure deformation, monitoring that would allow alarm bells to probably go off, or to potentially go off, I should say, and get people out of harm's way are expensive. And one of the many things that states have to contend with their budgetary practices. So I think engineers and geologists could give you a recipe to say, if you really want to know when and if this site is likely to move, we can instrument it, but are you willing to spend $50,000, maybe $100,000 a year per site? Things like that are the questions we have to ask, is how much do we want to spend to feel safe everywhere? Alternatively, there was an effort by the state and the county to buy a lot of the properties at the foot of that landslide. And at the time, the state balked at the $1.6, I believe it was, million-dollar price tag. So there is a history there that I don't want to get too much into the specifics. I'm not as up to speed on that. But there was some back and forth as to whether
whether they should simply try to prevent people from living in that area.
I was just going to say it might not directly answer your question, but from the other side of what do we do to prepare when something like this happens, organizations like the Red Cross are working on a daily basis from the national level to regional level to local level on how are we preparing our communities when something happens, whether it's a family home fire, an earthquake, or a mudslide. There's also the government that is involved in how are we preparing. Our local city officials are very involved, local emergency managers, FEMA, Department of Homeland Security. So there's a lot of effort that's being put into place on an everyday basis of how do we prepare as individuals, as companies, as communities when something does happen.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Milne, and my question is for Red Cross. I have two questions. First of all, it seems that Red Cross has such a good reputation, and conversely, FEMA does not. So what advice would you give FEMA on how to improve? I don't want to put you on the hot spot. Maybe you could just say what works for Red Cross. That's one question.
Okay. FEMA gets a bad rap sometimes, and I think as a governmental agency, at least in the past, it was seen that they did not respond as quickly as what they needed to. I think Katrina is probably a really very good example of that. And with the way that the government works, it's the local government that needs to ask for that assistance. So you could necessarily say, perhaps the local government wasn't as in touch with the folks at FEMA as they should have been. You could say that. Or you could say FEMA needs to stand forward a little bit more, which is what they have been doing in the recent past. Organizations like the American Red Cross, and I think it goes to our volunteers that are working with us. As an organization, we have about 60,000 volunteers nationwide that we work with on a very regular basis, individuals in each community that are there helping their community. I don't want to say, I don't know if I could provide input to FEMA on how they could do things better. I mean, we work very closely with FEMA on a very regular basis, and we work very closely, and I think that's the key, is the whole communication. And how are we working together before something happens? Because when it does happen, it's extremely chaotic. And it takes a little bit of time for either the power to get back up and running or the infrastructure to be put into place. And how are we knowing each other before it happens so we know what we can do working together? And again, that's where we are also working with our governmental partners. But yes, I think FEMA does sometimes get a bad rap.
And my second question is, if you would talk about your experience, your impressions at OSO and the human toll and how rescuers keep going, all your thoughts about that.
It was hard. It was a really, really hard relief operation. I've been involved with the organization for about 7 years now, and when I was in Washington, D.C., I worked on the disaster side of what we did, and I've been involved in a number of large disasters since the end of 2007. And incidences like OSO, I was also deployed after the Newtown, Connecticut shooting. And they're very emotional, and it's very draining. And I have to say, with the community, I worked on the Darrington side. I was not in Arlington as much. The town of Darrington is amazing, an extremely close-knit, tight community, very small community of about 1,400 people. At first, they didn't want the help. They're like, nope, we got it. We're good. We don't need your help. And our volunteers did an amazing job of working with them on a regular basis because we, as we do this more often than someone from Darrington has been in an event like this, you can see the signs. At first, it's like, I got it, I'm good. And then a couple days later, it's like, I think I might need a little bit of help. And then it's like, I think I need more help. With the OSO mudslide, the great toll on the community was mental health. This town, every person in that community has been affected, whether they lost a family member, a friend. Every single person in that community is affected, and they will be affected forever. They will always go back to what happened before. When I first got there, I met a gentleman. His name was Don Thompson. He's from the community. He was involved in the Darrington Community Center, which we were housed out of. And I talked to Don for a very long time, and he kept asking me question after question after question. And then it finally realized, I'm like, people don't understand the magnitude of what has happened, and they don't understand the magnitude of organizations like the American Red Cross, like Salvation Army, of what we do when something happens. And he kept saying, you know, how do you do this? How do you do this? And I said, well, you talk to people. You talk to your friends. You talk to your family. I said, you know, you're probably going to start getting phone calls from family members and friends from years that you've never heard from. He's like, my ex-wife just called me the other day, and I haven't heard from her in years. And that's what it is. It's a whole process. So organizations like the Red Cross, and there's a number of other organizations that are also assisting, will be helping this community for as long as we possibly can, as the community is helping itself. And I truly do believe that the town of Darrington and Oso will be stronger and a much tighter knit community than what they were before this happened. And they were strong to begin with. They'll be stronger.
Jerry Smith, City Club member from South Eugene. And my question is one of how safe is South Eugene? My experience in finding a house there was the first dozen houses that I looked at had, and most of the houses there are 40 years old when I got there, had cracked foundations. And I eventually picked one that didn't. Landscaping in that area is that roads follow what would be natural creek beds, and then on the side of the road, one side of your lot will be an embankment, and the other side of your lot will be a drop-off. How safe are those during either an earthquake or an extreme rain event?
Well, good question. On the wall here is a map of applying those databases I was talking about to our local community. And so you can see colored polygons that indicate steep areas, debris flow prone areas that, you know, potentially might spawn these rapid runout events, as well as some features that have failed in a more deep-seated fashion in the past. Now, in terms of the geology of our area, we have a landslide problem. They are around us. It's perhaps not as acute as the example we've seen in Oso, just because of the geologic setting, but big storms do big changes in slopes. And so saturation that occurs when a lot of rainfall accumulates can cause catastrophic movement. The thing about landslides, however, is they are this sort of slow, silent destructor. So most all of the landslide damage that happens is not the stuff that's on the front page. It's all those cracked foundations. It's all the headaches that incur when you have to redo lots and things like that. And there's, you know, numerous examples on the Oregon coast of coastal landslides that have scuttled development plans. So it's relatively rare that we have these examples that are so dramatic and catastrophic like this. It's much more of a low-grade chronic type of problem that we have. Now, in terms of those embankments and the position of your water, do everything you can to get water off of your landscape when it's raining. obviously you don't want to funnel it into your neighbor's yard. But, you know, stormwater systems and other surface drainage systems are really the key to this process, this problem, I should say, in that saturation is something, getting that water in the ground is really the biggest thing that promotes slope instability. So we want to try to move it off the landscape, route it as efficiently as we can.
Marlene Nessery, City Club member. My question is for Megan. And I come from a long line of cops and firefighters and first responders. And I know that there's been a lot of struggle around making sure that the communication systems and frequencies are integrated in some way so that each entity can do its part. But I'm wondering about how you can integrate new scientific knowledge. What systems do you have in place for integrating the kind of work that we heard about today into your planning and preparation?
Well, with the Red Cross, we do we don't have a team of geologists, but we do work with a number of people. We partner with the Weather Channel. We also have experts on our team that are looking at information like this. And while I might not be personally chatting with a geologist or Josh, someone like Josh, on a regular basis, we do have team members that are. I can tell you that we're also looking at, and have been looking at, how does social media play in a disaster. And I can tell you that Facebook has really changed how we respond to disasters. You can pinpoint things in a second now, where before you didn't know, for a couple of days. Now when something happens, sometimes people will tweet something or put something on Facebook before they'll call 911. So I can tell you when Hurricane Sandy happened, and we were getting information through Facebook. People were posting, I need help here and I need help here. We were actually moving our, we call them ERVs, emergency response vehicles, to those locations where people were saying there's a pocket of folks here. So social media has really changed how all of us respond to a disaster.
Thank you. Sandra Bishop, City Club member. You kind of answered part of my question, so I'm going to ask a question on the other side. But the first question I have is, who named it Slido? That was a good day in the Dogami office.
Like Sharknado?
Somebody got a good high five out of that one. But on a serious note, you talked a little bit earlier, Josh, about the expense of actually monitoring, because we have active slides. I know I was on the eWeb board. We have the Percy slide up the McKinsey, and it's, going to slide into a canal, and it does that on a regular basis. It has to be cleared out. So is there anything beyond that, beyond knowing about the individual slides, the road 30th going to LCC's got a slide, and, at certain times in the winter, that road's going to move. But is there any way on a larger scale, looking at the Pacific Rim, looking at the earthquake frequency, is there any way to, quote, predict or monitor or have any sort of warning about a major event that's likely to happen? And then the other side of the question I wanted to ask about the response, how much time it takes to respond if you have a major earthquake or something where all infrastructure shut down, how do you respond? So I guess the thing is, can you predict it all in any reliable way?
I'll say a few words and just then defer to Megan. Great question about massive and the region-wide scale events. And if you change the word from prediction to early warning, we have a lot more to say. Prediction, we are still far on that task. But I have colleagues that are specifically working on earthquakes, and early warning systems are in play right now. They have been developed in Japan, and they are in the process of being developed here in the Pacific Northwest, specifically with the goal of looking at the precursors to these massive subduction zone events. That's really the big one that we're worried about. These magnitude 9 events, we know to within probably an hour or two when the last one occurred. It was in January back in 1700. We know that from buried forests along the coast and the tsunami that hit Japan that had no source for the tsunami, and it was eventually connected with the last Cascadia subduction zone earthquake 314 years ago. So when the Earth starts to move in particular ways, the earthquake early warning systems suggest that we may have on the order of tens of seconds, perhaps, to get ready. Now, that's a lot or a little, depending. It's enough to shut down critical facilities, get in position. It does raise questions on how do you get the word out. Social media, all the other things that we've talked about are becoming an increasingly big part of that discussion. But the science behind that early warning system, is happening right now. It has not been instituted, so don't be looking to your cell phones or anything like that yet. It's, you know, still a ways off from being implemented, but it is actively in the works.
And then what to do to prepare when something happens. I mean, you could say for an incident like Oso, can you really prepare? That's something that's going to be within seconds and it takes your whole house away. I don't know if you can prepare for that. However, you can prepare for other types of disasters, whether it's a home fire, a wildfire, a hurricane, whatever. And it's the way the American Red Cross is preparing. We're working with our partners. We also have supplies on hand. We have cots, we have blankets, we have cleanup kits. We have supplies stationed in the Eugene area, in the Florence area, in Roseburg, and this is the way our organization works as a whole. So the local chapter will prepare locally, and then once an event does happen, it is our responsibility to make sure that we have shelters in place, that make sure that we have feeding agreements, that we can feed people, make sure that we can get them water, make sure we can at least take care of those basic needs, and then we will start bringing in reinforcements. As an organization, we have five large warehouses strategically placed across the country. The closest one here is in Reno, Nevada, where we have thousands and thousands of cots and blankets and comfort kits and cleanup kits. Then there's also the personal responsibility. You know, how are individuals making sure that they are prepared? Do you have enough water stored for three days? Do you have enough food? Do you have some of your medications? Do you perhaps have some cash put aside in case the power is not working and you can't get to your ATM? So there's the individual responsibility, and then there's the responsibility of organizations like the Red Cross and also the government. I will say that I did provide some booklets, Together We Prepare, with some information inside of there how you as individuals can prepare your own families for when something does happen.
Otto Petitia, City Club member. I'm curious that after a slide, how long does it take before you can develop that site again? And is also a great place to build right now, since it's had its slide.
Why don't you go?
I'll say something, and then again defer to Megan. These, particularly at Oso, it's not like earthquakes where after the big earthquake has occurred, you've got a period of stasis or a period of quiet. That valley is filled with these weak, steep sediment cliffs. And so that is a place that I would avoid wanting to be in, just because of that history we've now seen with the LIDAR data, and then this recent example being one of those.
I would say for the town of Oso, I mean, it was pretty much wiped away, the town itself. The road has just been, Route 530 has just been recently opened for two-way traffic, and I do understand that they're going to be looking at developing another area where Highway 530 will be put. The town of Darrington, I don't think the town of Darrington the folks will ever leave there. It's their home. They've grown up there. I guess you could also ask, you know, why do people put homes on the ocean or when hurricanes are coming or in the Gulf? It's a beautiful area up there. I could see myself living up there very easily. But it's the risk I think everyone has to take when you're looking at, you know, you're building a house right next to a cliff, you know, what could happen, or you're building a house on the ocean and you know hurricanes come through all the time. It's the risk that you take.
Thank you for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program, the Osso Mudslides Lessons for Oregon. And thanks again to our sponsors, Sacred Earth Botanicals, KLCC Radio, and Hearing Associates. We will meet again next Friday, July 18th, at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear the Oregon Country Fair, Rooted in Philanthropy. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you so much for joining us today.